Pacifica Radio. From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
War does not end strife, it sows seeds. War does not end hatred, it feeds it.
Congress members debate war. Today, we'll talk about terror with Sister Diana Ortiz and Chilean writer Ariel Dorfman.
People keep on using the word terror and they speak about fear. And with Sister Diana Ortiz, I think we have something to contribute to this debate about what it really means to have to be terrorized and how you get rid of fear.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Congress is poised to authorize President Bush to unilaterally attack Baghdad as the five permanent members of the UN Security Council inch toward agreement on an Iraq resolution. The House of Representatives is scheduled to vote today after concluding over 24 hours of debate early this morning. More than 100 House members are expected to oppose the measure. A vote in the Democratic-controlled Senate could be delayed by threats of a filibuster by an opponent, Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia. The five permanent Security Council members, meanwhile, appeared close to agreement on tough new terms for disarming Iraq. Diplomats said Wednesday that the United States seemed willing to drop some proposals to give inspectors more muscle in exchange for a resolution spelling out severe consequences if Iraq fails to disarm. Russia's initial opposition to tough action against Iraq is seen as softening. France has announced it will not use its veto. China remains wary of military action but sticks to an official line that it's too early to comment on any draft resolution. A senior Kremlin official indicated Russia would demand a high price for its support in the bombing of Iraq, but that it would not ultimately stand in America's way. This according to the London Telegraph. Moscow is looking for a guarantee that the price of oil will not fall below $18 a barrel. Russia relies on oil for half its external income and fears if Saddam Hussein is deposed by the United States that may flood the market with cheap Iraqi oil to bolster its own economy. Moscow also wants to ensure that Russian companies will be able to keep valuable oil fields in western Iraq if Saddam Hussein is deposed. The minister in charge of Iraq's weapons programs has denied that Baghdad has amassed biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons and has invited the United States to come and inspect sites. He said the U.S. should allow the United Nations to send its weapons inspectors back to the country immediately and invited journalists and members of the Bush administration to visit two sites of concern, Furat and Nasr al-Azim. Despite talks between Iraq and the U.N. on restarting weapons inspections, the U.S. has said it does not want them to resume until a new resolution is passed in the Security Council. NBC News is reporting the U.S. Air Force has recently begun using unmanned armed drones to attack Iraqi defense sites. Until now, the Predator had only been used in combat by the CIA during the Afghanistan war. In addition to carrying missiles, the Predator sends back real-time surveillance video to military and government command centers, enabling U.S. commanders to monitor ground activity. Four Palestinians were killed, 17 more injured during an Israeli attack in the Rafah refugee camp in the southern Gaza Strip. In the West Bank, Israeli soldiers raided Palestinian towns and villages overnight, arresting more than 70 people. Meanwhile, in Tel Aviv, a suicide attack killed one Israeli woman and injured 17. The top human rights official in Colombia has urged the government to suspend U.S.-backed aerial fumigation of coca crops in the south of the country. The Colombian state's human rights watchdog, the People's Defender, accused the authorities of damaging the health of local people and the environment in the province of Putumayo. Every year, the U.S. government finances the aerial fumigation of more fields of coca and poppy, the raw materials for cocaine and heroin. And every year, the number of hectares under drug cultivation goes up, along with the amount of virgin forest destroyed. Environmentalists complain that the herbicides used damage the environment, killing all plant life, not just drug crops. The U.S. has acknowledged it carried out a sweeping Cold War-era test program of chemical and germ warfare agents in Britain, the United States, and Vieques. An unknown number of civilians were exposed at the time to simulants, or what were then thought to be harmless agents meant to stand in for deadlier ones, according to the Pentagon. Some of those were later discovered to be dangerous. Civilians and soldiers in or around Vieques, Puerto Rico, were also likely exposed. As many as 5,500 members of the U.S. Armed Forces were involved, including 5,000 who took part in previously disclosed shipboard experiments in the Pacific in the 1960s. This once classified information was released amid U.S. charges that Iraq has continued building weapons of mass destruction despite disarmament requirements at the end of the 1991 Gulf War. On Wednesday, the two most senior Democrats in Congress urged President Bush to sack Harvey Pitt, chair of the Securities and Exchange Commission. Senator Tom Daschle and Congressmember Richard Gephardt said Bush should replace Pitt, quote, given the growing number of his inappropriate or improper actions. The SEC is paralyzed over the selection of the head of the accountancy regulator, one of the central parts of legislation designed to restore faith in the integrity of corporate America. Pitt had indicated to John Biggs, outgoing head of a large U.S. pension fund, that he would be offered the job. But leaks of the offer angered Republicans as well as former clients of Pitt's. And now the White House says it has reservations about Biggs. And finally, Tony Mizaki, a longtime advocate for workplace safety, whose disenchantment with traditional politics led him to organize the nation's first Labor Party in 70 years, died at his home in Washington, D.C. on Saturday. He was 76 years old. He died of pancreatic cancer. Tony Mizaki brought 1,400 union leaders to a Cleveland convention hall in 1996 to form the Labor Party. Labeled a foolhardy idea by many, it was conceived in an era of waning union strength and has fewer than 14,000 members, but Mizaki believed in the future of a party that represented working people. His slogan was, "The bosses have two parties. We need one of our own."
America's war machine, destroying our nation that had been once prosperous, providing for its needs. And the sanctions on Iraq, the lives lost we can't take back. Save the people of Iraq, the war is over. Stop the bombing of Iraq, the lives lost we can't take back. Save the people of Iraq. Yes, the war is over. See the old and children die, all because of America's lies that punishes the whole people for one leader's sins.
One. America's war machine. Here on Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Hi, Juan.
Hi, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the nation. Amy, on this day when the Bush administration, ably assisted by the servile corporate press of America, continues to drag our nation closer and closer to a second oil war of the last 15 years.
You know, watching the debate into the wee hours of this morning in the House of Representatives, as our producer Mike Burke said, after 11 o'clock, if you tuned in, you felt like you were at an anti-war rally. They were all saved, not all, of course, but many of those that were going to get a quarter of the time were saved till very late last night.
Well, I mean, those of us who are not insomniacs like you and don't stay up that late, we're treated throughout the day to Congress members who I was amazed at the number who expressed their deep reservations and their disbelief of the Bush administration, but were nonetheless voting for the resolution and the various rationalizations that they used for that vote. Those are the rest of us who keep day hours had to listen to the other side.
Well, we're going to listen to some excerpts of speeches in our first segment, and then we're going to be joined by Sister Diana Ortiz, who is the American nun who was raped and tortured in Guatemala by Guatemalan officers, and she believes a U.S. man was in charge of them. She's written a new book called The Blindfold's Eyes, My Journey from Torture to Truth. And we'll talk about terror with the Chilean writer Ariel Dorfman. But first, we're going to go now to the floor of the House, where this week many people took their message to the American people. One of them was Georgia Congress member John Lewis, longtime civil rights leader.
Mr. Speaker, I want to thank my friend, my colleague, Donald Payne, for yielding. Mr. Speaker, my colleagues, I rise to speak against this resolution. I rise to speak for peace. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Be they Christian, Jew, Muslim, Buddhist, Sikh, be they white, black, yellow, red, or brown. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Today we must ask ourselves, are we peacemakers? Will we cast aside our fears of prejudice, our hate, and embrace peace? Will we sow the seeds of peace, or are we just another nation sowing the seeds of war? War will Iraq will sow seeds in the desert sands of the Middle East and throughout the world. What fruit will our actions bear? Not just for us, but for our children, and not just for the children of our own land, for the children of the West and the Middle East and the world. For even it is the children, our little boys and girls, who must live with the consequences of our war. What do we gain? What do our children gain when we have destroyed another nation? What do we gain when we have killed hundreds and thousands of their men, women, and children, when hundreds of our sons and daughters have died? War with Iraq will not bring peace to the Middle East. It will not make the world a safer, a better, a more loving place. It will not end the strife and hatred that breed terror. War does not end strife, it sows seeds. War does not end hatred, it feeds it. War is bloody, it is vicious, it is evil, and it is messy. War destroys the dreams, the hopes, and aspirations of people. As a great nation and blessed people, we must heed the words of the spiritual. I'm going to lay my burden down by the riverside. I ain't going to stir that war no more. For those who argue that war is a necessary evil, I say you're half right. War is evil, but it is not necessary. War cannot be a necessary evil because nonviolence is a necessary good. The two cannot coexist. As Americans, as human beings, as citizens of the world, as moral actors, we must embrace the good and reject the evil. Gandhi said the choice is nonviolence or non-existent. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said, we must learn to live together as brothers and sisters or perish as fools. There's something greater than military victory, bigger and greater than regime change and toppling governments. It is to this greater good that as a nation and as a people, we must aspire. And the scripture said, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? America's strength is not in its military might, but in our ideas. America's ingenuity, freedom, and democracy have conquered the world. It is a battle that we did not win with guns or tanks or missiles, but with ideas, principles, and justice. We must use our resources not to make bombs and guns, but to solve the problem that affects humankind. We must feed the stomach, close the naked bodies, educate and stimulate the mind. We must use our resources to build and not to tear down, to reconcile and not to divide, to love and not to hate, to heal and not to kill. This is the direction in which a great nation should move. War is easy, but peace is hard. When we hurt, when we feel vulnerable or hopeless, it is easy to listen to what is most base within us. It is easy to divide the world into us and them, to fear them, to hate them, to fight them, to kill them. War is easy, but peace is hard. Peace is right, it is just, and it is true. I know it's not easy to love thy enemy, No peace is hard. So we have war in Israel and no peace. We have war in Kashmir, but no peace. We have war in Afghanistan, in Colombia, in Sudan, in the Philippines, and no peace. It may be hard, it may be difficult, but the quest for peace is as old as the dawn of history and as fresh as the morning newspaper. My colleagues, my brothers and sisters, sometimes, someplace, leaders of a great nation, we have the courage to say we will lay down the burden, the tools, and the instrument of war. We will wage peace and not war. And that nation will be blessed, for they shall be called the children of God. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Democratic Congressmember John Lewis of Georgia.
And now we'll be hearing from Ohio Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, who is well known for her leading the fight against NAFTA several years ago.
Mr. Speaker, 3 weeks before election seems to be an odd time to be authorizing war. It is especially odd when President Bush himself said at the United Nations that Iraq represents a grave and gathering threat, not an imminent threat. For a month, this debate has frozen off the front pages: Social Security, prescription drugs, rising unemployment, growing deficits, robbery of pension accounts, corporate abuses, and the inaction of this Congress itself. The generals have not weighed in either. Retired General Norman Schwarzkopf, who headed the Persian Gulf War campaign, called on President Bush not to go it alone. Retired General Wesley Clark, who headed up the Balkans campaign, called on President Bush not to go it alone. Former National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft said an attack on Iraq without addressing the problems of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict could turn the whole region into a cauldron and thus destroy the war on terrorism. Last weekend, Israel's chief of military intelligence, speaking on television, disputed contentions that Iraq is 18 months away from nuclear capability. He concluded Iraq's time frame was more like 4 years. And he said Iran's nuclear threat was as great as Iraq's. Yes, Congress, on behalf of the American people, must decide whether the United States' incursion now into Iraq will make our country more secure and whether it will make that region more stable. On both counts, my conclusion is no. It won't make America safer because unilateral military action without broad international support will isolate America further. It will thrust us into the position of becoming a common enemy in a volatile region where anti-Western terrorism grows with each passing year. It won't make the region more stable either. The Bush approach will yield more terrorism and instability, not less. We should insist on rigorous inspections in concert with our allies and enforce all UN resolutions relating to the Middle East. Indeed, if the politics of the oil regimes and lethal force had been successful over the past 25 years, America's citizens would not be the victims of escalating terrorist violence at home and abroad. Since 1975, more American diplomats and military personnel have been killed or taken as hostage as a result of Middle Eastern tumult than in the first 187 years of our nation's history. And it worsens with each decade. After 9/11, 3,025 additional names of civilians here at home were added to that growing list. Look more deeply at the roots of the rising levels of hatred and terrorism toward our people. Even if Iraq were able to serve as an instrument of global terrorism, the causes of that terrorism will not disappear with the demise of Saddam Hussein. The enemy has many fresh faces. They spring daily from the growing resentment of Western influence over an Islamic world that is awakening to its own political destiny. America must not wed itself to the past, but to the rising aspirations of subjugated people, and we must do it in concert with our friends both inside the Arab world and outside it. What propels the violence? A deep and powerful undercurrent moving people to violence in that region is the unresolved Israeli-Palestinian conflict. The other major destabilizing force is America's utter and dangerous dependence on imported oil, whose purchases undergird repressive regimes. We must address both. Think about it. Modern terrorism dawned in our homeland in June 1968 with the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. The unresolved Israeli-Palestinian conflict lay at the basis of that tragic loss. His disgruntled assassin, a Jordanian Arab, revealed in his diary that loss of his homeland in East Jerusalem lay at the root of his discontent. Sirhan Sirhan is one such face. The intifada now proceeding in the West Bank and Gaza proves the lingering tragedy of the Holy Land resists peaceful resolution until today, and its irresolution instructs the street and produces sacred rage. Now let's look at oil, the one word the president left out of his address in Cincinnati. As the 1970s proceeded, America's economic security came to be shaped more and more by events abroad. Thrust into two deep recessions due to the Arab oil embargoes back then, as petroleum prices shot through the roof, our economy faltered. And the current recession, too, has been triggered by rising oil prices. Meanwhile, America, rather than becoming energy independent at home, sinks deeper into foreign oil dependence from the undemocratic regimes of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Iraq, to also include the state-owned monopolies of Nigeria and Venezuela and Mexico. While our military enforces the no-fly zones over Iraq, we import 8% of our oil from her. America has become more and more hostage to the oil regimes, with our future intertwined with the politics that Islamic fundamentalism breeds in the Muslim world.
And that was Congressmember Marcy Kaptur of Ohio. But it wasn't just opposition that was expressed inside the House of Representatives. Outside as well, there were over 100 people who protested at rush hour yesterday. 13 were arrested outside the Capitol. Some are still being held. Many members of the Pledge of Resistance being held charged with unlawful assembly. And in New York, a group of 14 people were arrested outside the offices of Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton, among them Carmen Trotta of the Catholic Worker. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy. Thank you.
Why did you go outside Hillary Clinton's office?
Well, certainly it should be mentioned that our action also, which is 80 people outside of Hillary Clinton's office, 14 of whom ended up getting arrested, is also part of the Iraq Pledge of Resistance, the same group. It was October 7th. That's the anniversary of an unnecessary bombing of Afghanistan. I think most of us would agree that that bombing was not vengeful. Rather, it was opportunistic. And the opportunities for bombing seem to abound within the Bush administration. So now we're talking about Iraq. Senator Clinton, who was very close to the issue as First Lady with Bill Clinton, is seemingly most insulated from the truth, in part because perhaps she's most directly indicted by the truth, the truth being that we are responsible for enormous carnage and the deaths of thousands upon thousands of children in Iraq. And the legal and moral claims here are very clear. We have no right to bomb Iraq. Rather, we should be paying reparations. But insulated from that, as she is, I think she is concerned primarily with whatever forwards her own political ambitions. So we went in front of the office and, along with others around the country, decided to engage in direct action. We weren't asking to dialogue with Ms. Clinton. We wanted to tell her what she needed to do, because she would be in violation of the law and in violation of all that is ethical were we to do another bombing campaign of Iraq.
And her stance so far on President Bush's request for a war authorization?
Somehow, impossibly, she remains undecided. Of all people to remain undecided, someone that was that close to the issue and should have been able to come to some moral clarity and clarity about the legal issues, she remains somehow lost.
On what grounds were you arrested?
Oddly enough, we were told, actually, when we got there, Amy, immediately, preemptively, we were told by the police that were we to enter any office building, we would be subject to arrest. So we didn't actually enter the building. Most of us didn't actually enter the building. But we were on private property, and we were leafing. There wasn't a blockade of the doors or anything. Senator Clinton's office says they had nothing to do with the arrest. That seems almost impossible, being that the police were told us preemptively that we wouldn't be able to go into the building.
Carmen Trotta of the Catholic Work Movement. When we come back, we're going to hear from some listeners, and then Chilean writer Ariel Dorfman and Sister Diana Ortiz will talk about terror. Stay with us.
Towers lie in rubble at the the center of a world trade, the latest lethal commerce, the signpost of the age, funeral pyre still burning, people are afraid that there's no place to hide, has never been quite this plain. Some bold souls with convictions and reasons thought enough hijack those jet airliners, turn them into bombs. The CIA trained the masters, they learned their lessons well, came back from Afghanistan to blow us all to hell. The war has come home, you can smell it in the street. Oh, you can't wipe it away from your eyes. The war has come home, you can taste it on your teeth. Cries of vengeance.
Unholy War, Lastridge here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, people have been calling in our comment line and talking back to war.
Massachusetts. I represent the Northampton Committee to lift the sanctions and stop the bombing on Iraq. On Monday, the 7th, the anniversary of the beginning of the bombing of Afghanistan, we had a community speak out, but it was preceded by a pot banging in front of the courthouse. And we expected just a few of us to come to the pot banging, and it turned out that there were nearly 250 people who gathered. And we had a wonderful time expressing our outrage at what's going on in our government, but also joyfully coming together to celebrate our unity. And people had pots and pans and wash tubs and tambourines and bells and drums and all kinds of instruments.
Hi, this is Ellen Robbins. I'm calling from Baltimore, Maryland. What I'm calling about is that a student just told me, she's a teacher in the Baltimore public schools, that one quarter of all the kids in Baltimore were left back last year in a new sort of change in education policy. And she told me that all the kids who were in high school who were left back got letters from the military trying to get them to sign up so that so there'll be these minority kids who are failing in school, will be called up to fight.
My name is Ibrahim Zumatin. I'm listening to Democracy Now! On BAI in Brooklyn. Okay, I work for a youth program, and I'm just trying to do counter-recruitment on a daily basis. And I don't want anyone to have to go to war, and this is really scary. So I just work with the young people and try and plug. The war is definitely not the answer. Peace.
Hi, Amy. My name is Nora Barrows-Friedman, and I'm calling from Albany, California. I'm 23 years old, and I'm the mother of a beautiful 2-year-old daughter. And I just wake up every morning heart sick and heartbroken about the state of the world. And, it gets so frustrating trying to teach my daughter not to hit when our government is hitting. I've gotten together with a bunch of other parents. We're now the Play for Peace contingent. And we're going to be setting up times to play for our children in various locations and playgrounds and parks. We're going to make up a big banner that says, "We're playing for peace," and bringing balloons, kind of a balloons, not bombs. And it's something positive and creative and fun that we can do, to kind of lean on each other and support each other during this frustrating, hard, and sad and sick time. So we're also going to be a little contingent in the October 26th march in San Francisco.
And there is an October 26th march in Washington, D.C. as well. Just a few of the comments of our listeners talking back to war. And you can let us know what you're doing, how you feel, by calling 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. You are listening to Democracy Now! And Juan, I've had this strange experience going to buy the newspapers in the morning. There's this horrible story that a lot of people have heard about now this week of the sniper in the greater Washington, D.C. area, Maryland, Virginia. And no one knows where he'll strike next. And after Bush's speech, I went the next day to buy the newspapers, and one of them said, "Who's next?" And the other headline was, "He kills for fun." And I started to get a little...
You thought they were talking about Bush.
...confused. And I started to think about these two parallel stories, the horror for people in the D.C. area not knowing who is next, people being terrorized, and then thinking about people all over the world. Today's headline is, "I am God," because apparently some tarot card was found. "I am God," quote from the person. What people think about all over the world, wondering if they're next as the U.S. wages its so-called war on terror. It's a kind of global sniper politics, right? This one has a high-velocity weapon. The U.S. government has an entire arsenal. Well,
you know, I think part of the problem, of course, is that in this country we have so many mass media outlets, but so little real information that gets to the American people. And as Neil Postman has once said, in the United States, the problem is not that people are misinformed; it's that they are disinformed. And the difference being that when you are misinformed, you just don't have the right information. When you are disinformed, you don't have the right information, but you think you do. And that's the problem of disinformation in the United States that's been so prevalent for so many years.
Well, talking about disinformation and talking about terror, we're joined by two people right now for the rest of the program. Sister Deanna Ortiz is with us. She bravely begins her book tour. She has just written a book called The Blindfold's Eyes, My Journey from Torture to Truth. And it is about her story as an American nun who went down to teach kids in Guatemala and how she was picked up by Guatemalan security and tortured and raped and did live to tell about it, unlike a number of other people who were tortured in the same place as she was. We're also joined by Ariel Dorfman, the renowned Chilean writer, formerly exiled writer, now just expatriate writer. But talking about truth and disinformation, Ariel, I was wondering if you could start off. You've written the book Exercising Terror, The Incredible Unending Trial of General Augusto Pinochet. But you also have a book of poetry, In Case of Fire in a Foreign Land, New and Collected Poems from Two Languages. If you could read Last Will and Testament.
Yes, and I'll read this particularly for Deanna. That way we feel as if we're here in a family listening to poetry, as we have done so often, my dear, right? So I'm gonna read a very, very briefly. I'm gonna just say some words in Spanish to begin with, because it was written in Spanish. And Testamento, Last Will and Testament. Cuando te digan que no estoy preso, no les creas. When they tell you I'm not a prisoner, don't believe them. They'll have to admit it someday. When they tell you they released me, don't believe them. They'll have to admit it's a lie someday. When they tell you I betrayed the party, don't believe them. They'll have to admit I was loyal someday. When they tell you I'm in France, don't believe them. Don't believe them when they show you my false ID. Don't believe them. Don't believe when they show you the photo of my body. Don't believe them. Don't believe them when they tell you the moon is the moon. If they tell you the moon is the moon, that this is my voice on tape, that this is my signature on a confession. If they say a tree is a tree, don't believe them. Don't believe anything they tell you, anything they swear to, anything they show you. Don't believe them. And finally, when that day comes, when they ask you to identify the body and you see me and a voice says, we killed him. The poor bastard died. He's dead. When they tell you I am completely, absolutely, definitely dead. Don't believe them. Don't believe them. Don't believe them.
Ariel Dorfman. His book from In Case, his poem from In Case of Fire in a Foreign Land. Today we're going to talk about terror in the context of the so-called war on terror. Ariel, your thoughts?
Well, you know, terror works very effectively on an individual basis. People are terrorized one by one by one, and then they are terrorized collectively because of that form that happens. It's an intervention. This idea you said about I am God, it has to do with the fact that some men, primarily men, not women, decide that they are gods
and that they can impose pain, terror, and death upon others. Now, the terror that was visited on the United States, which of course was a horrible atrocity, has opened the door for the government of the United States to think that they can impose terror on anybody they want in the world, as if this will wash away the terror visited upon you. And that is, of course, the absolutely wrong way to deal with that. Partly my book and partly my poems and my literature, and I think in a great measure the book that Deanna has just published, is a way in which we are answering that by saying, well, what do you do when you are terrorized? I mean, how do you react when you have suffered in unbearable pain, unbearable collective and individual terror? What do you do with that? Do you react with outrage, anger? Anger, yes. Do you impose terror on those who have created terror on you? Or do you find ways in which you can heal the world because you have tasted the worst of humanity? And in that sense, you know, my book certainly, and I know that Deanna's book in that sense, is sort of like a model for peace and for justice, because it's not as if we're being soft. On the contrary, the people who are soft are the ones who think that if they just bomb somebody, they can get rid of the problem. This is a sort of an answer of gentleness and great strength. And I'm trying to find a way in which we can heal the world. And Pinochet's book, in a great measure, is an attempt to show how bringing one terrorist to justice can help create a world which is more secure for everybody who is fighting for that justice.
But, of course, in this country, the problem that we have is that, for the most part, the American people know so little about the reality of the terror that has occurred in other countries, often with the support and complicity or backing of our own government. And, of course, the clearest example is Guatemala. Perhaps the greatest amount of terror in this hemisphere in recent memory that the American people know largely very little about. And it wasn't until the recent Truth Commission documented the complicity of the United States government in that genocide that occurred there, that the first real public recognition of this by our government, by President Clinton, occurred. And I'd like to ask Sister Deanna Ortiz, in terms of your deciding to write this book and coming here to the United States, clearly spreading across the country to speak about your own experiences, what connection you're hoping to make with the American people in terms of owning up to our own history and our own involvement, or our government's involvement in what happened in Guatemala.
First, I'd like to say thank you for having me here. I'm humbled to be in your presence. At first glance, the blindfold's eyes tells or gives the impression that it's my story. And it's true, it is my experience. But I think it's important to convey that it is the story of thousands and thousands of torture survivors from Guatemala, from Africa, East Timor, just from many countries. And as one person who has survived a form of terror, which is called torture. And I think it's very important that those of us who are able, those of us who have survived torture, that if we're capable, and I don't want to say capable, because I think that each of us can contribute in his or own way how to bring justice and peace to the world, even if it means getting up in the morning. That's a form of resistance. But there are some survivors of torture who have opted to use their horrible experience to break the silence of torture. And that's one of the purposes of the book, is to break that silence and to help people around the world, and in particular the American public, become aware that torture is a crime against humanity. I am a U.S. citizen, and I went to Guatemala in 1987 as a Catholic missionary, thinking that I was safe. For one thing, I was a U.S. citizen. That was supposed to secure me. And what I learned was that no one is immune to torture. And there is talk now about legalizing torture in the United States. And all I can say is, if we move in that direction, we're in a horrible state.
In 1989, you were at a convent in Guatemala. Why did the Guatemalan military target you, and how did they first come and kidnap you?
If you don't mind, I'm going to read a section from the book, because that's a question that has been asked of me by many people, and in particular the U.S. government.
This is Sister Diana Ortiz, and she has testified before Congress. She has now written her book with Patricia Davis, The Blindfold's Eyes, My Journey from Torture to Truth.
Mimi and Darlene are two of the sisters who lived with me in Guatemala. Mimi and Darlene and I were confused about why I was targeted. We had no inkling that the Army had devised a new strategy. But the U.S. ambassador to Guatemala, Thomas Strook, explained the strategy in a later declassified analysis he sent to Secretary of State James Baker. That the victims are generally unknown in wider society means a more muted reaction both locally and abroad. It makes the question, why, more difficult to answer, and many non-political explanations, example, common crime, can plausibly be put forward to explain the victimization of a relatively anonymous person. While the victims are not figures of wide renown, they are well known within the small groups comprising the left. The bolt from the blue strike against one of their members causes a ripple of terror to go through those groups. For instance, he wasn't even the most important one in our group. If they are willing to get him, nobody is safe. Forcing many members into hiding or exile, or at least into abandoning whatever immediate project the group had.
And that was a declassified memo of the U.S. ambassador to Guatemala, Thomas Strook, who, when it came to your case, said that after you had been kidnapped, tortured, mutilated, your body burned with cigarettes more than 100 times, raped, left for dead, that you were lying, that you had engaged in a self-kidnapping?
A hoax. That I was a political strategist, that what happened to me didn't really happen. There were rumors from other officials in the embassy as well as the Guatemalan government that the 111 or 10, 11 burns on my back alone came as a result of kinky love sex. From the very beginning, the U.S. Embassy tried to silence me, and the attempt was through a smear campaign.
And what about the involvement of the U.S. government in your torture? You've long suspected, others have as well, that there was direct involvement. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
At one point during the torture, I don't want to go back into the past,
right.
But at one certain period, my torturers made reference to Alejandro, and I assumed they were referring to another Guatemalan who was a member of the death squad. And later I was taken to the same room where I had been interrogated. And that's when I became aware of a fourth person in the room, and they referred to him as Alejandro, and they told him to come and have fun. And that's when I realized he used a term that was quite familiar in the United States, and I guess I automatically assumed that, you know, he must be American or have some connections with the American embassy or whatever. And he spoke to me in poor Spanish, and at one point during when he escorted me out of the building, he spoke to me in perfect American English, and he told me that he was going to take me to the U.S. Embassy to see a friend who would help me leave the country. And I think it's also very important to convey is that Alejandro was not Guatemalan. He was tall, white skin. He was wearing a wig. And to this day, I believe that he was an American, and no one can change my mind. And I feel strongly that I, as a survivor of torture, the people of Guatemala, and the American people have a right to know what an American was doing in a clandestine prison, telling people that they could torture innocent people. You know, torture is a crime against humanity. No one deserves to be tortured, not even those who torture.
As he was driving you, he said to the U.S. Embassy, you jumped out of the Jeep, and that's when you made your escape?
That's correct.
We're talking to Sister Diana Ortiz. She's written her story, The Blindfold's Eyes, My Journey from Torture to Truth. Also, Chilean writer Ariel Dorfman. We're going to break for 60 seconds and then come back.
A hold on me still. The freedom movement made me an organizer while I was studying on the GI Bill. Luck of the leader is to be locked up. 23 years counting, 8 in the hole. I am not famous, I'm not Mandela, but I am imprisoned in a jail. My name is Geronimo Gijago, and my soul is not...
If you can see me, Rebel Voices, here, Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report, as Congress debates war, we talk about terror. We're joined by Sister Diana Ortiz, an American nun who was tortured in Guatemala and escaped and has lived to tell and write about it and to speak out against torture. I was recently down in Washington, D.C. at a conference she organized of torture victims from around the world. I don't think I had been in a group of such a powerful group of people who were taking on the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service, taking on U.S. policy. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Also there was Ariel Dorfman, and he's written several books, a book of poetry and Exorcising Terror, The Incredible Unending Trial of General Augusto Pinochet is his latest. As we talk about torture and terror, September 11th has significance beyond 2001. Can you talk about that, Ariel?
Well, you know, there are many September 11ths. September 11th, 2001 is a terrible date, and it is a date when terror was visited upon the most powerful nation in the world. But September 11th, 1973 was a date when terror was visited, it was a Tuesday as well, from the skies upon another country, Chile, with the complicity of the United States. I'm not saying this to blame the United States, but merely to point out that we have to find ways of stopping the September 11ths from repeating themselves, because many innocent people die. September 11th is happening right now, and in fact, it may be happening in Iraq tomorrow. It may be happening in Sudan yesterday. It may be happening here again. We have to find ways of stopping it. And one of the ways which I certainly have tried to do this is to point out how common our humanity is. You know, I wanted to say something because I was very moved, of course, to be here with my friend Diana, listening to her and seeing her struggle with the need to tell her story. It's very, very difficult. It is not easy what we are. We are witnessing something very special here, which is that she's able to speak. But she knows, and I know, and many of us know, that there are many, many, many out there who cannot speak, who dare not speak. I'm not only talking about the dead, who of course cannot speak, and who are a great majority of those victims, but those who have been terrorized into silence, because what they desire, what the people who create terror want, is for people to react angrily and to be very silent. Now, Diana has managed to find a way of telling her story because she is, don't blush, my dear, but you're very exceptional in that sense, you know. But you know very well that we have many people who don't. The case of this Pinochet book matters, I think, because until General Pinochet was arrested in London And we couldn't arrest him in our own country. We had the terrorist as the head of our armed forces. He was arrested in London. Until that happened, thousands upon thousands of victims of General Pinochet's repression were unable to speak one word about what had happened to them. When they saw him arrested, when they saw him indicted, when they saw him stripped of his immunity, when they saw him faced with these, with what he had done, when the mirror of his terror was brought to bear upon him, their voices began to appear. Not the voice of Diana Ortiz, exceptional human being, the voice of every exceptional but very scared human being. So I tell lots of stories. I let all those stories start coming out in this book, because what's extraordinary is as General Pinochet is cornered, then we find that these voices of the victims can begin to cease being victims. And Diana knows that being a victim is not a good thing. On the contrary, it's the wrong thing to do. You can't help it. But to be trapped in victimhood is precisely what the terrorists want you to do, because that makes you passive. So the story of General Pinochet's indictment and judgment and trial, which is a thriller, really, as I tell it.
Arrested in London in 1998.
In 1998. It's the way in which slowly voices can begin to come to the surface and tell the real story of what happened to them. And if we could do something similar in relation to the world, if we could find ways of creating systems of international justice, which exist, which the Bush administration is denying, we could find real ways of dealing with terror, not bomb, but find peaceful justification, in other words, through a system of international justice. That's a very, very strong possibility of doing that. And then we would have voices such as Sister Diana's coming out in droves.
Well, and of course, in South Africa, when once a majority rule was established, they proceeded to a truth commission, which is an enormous, it was an enormous psychological process for the entire nation to go through to hear the stories of the torture and the repression that had occurred in South Africa. But yet we have here the United States and the Bush administration refusing to participate in any kind of international court that might be able to judge crimes against humanity of this type. And what do you think in the rest of the world the reaction is to the Bush administration's refusal to participate in such a court?
Well, they think that Bush says what the sniper says: I am God. Therefore, I am not accountable to the rest of humanity. Now, the International Criminal Court stipulates that if there is a crime against humanity, and we're not talking about retroactively, so to say that Kissinger is going to be indicted by this court is ridiculous. He's not going to be indicted by that court. He might be indicted by some other court. But the fact is that crimes against humanity that are committed from the moment that court began to function, which was this July, from that moment onward, if the person can be indicted in their own country, they're not brought to the criminal court. So if, let's say, a U.S. Commander were to indiscriminately bomb Paris, let's say, give an example, right? The first criminal court to see that would not be a Parisian court or the court in Rome or international court. It would be a court in Washington, D.C. So there are guarantees for all the countries. It's just the United States does not consider that it should have anything to do with international law. And the idea of preemptive strikes, by the way, is also against international moral law. It's a very, I think we're at the most dangerous moment in the history of humanity since the atom bomb was exploded over Hiroshima. That is my impression, that we may be heading for apocalypse, because we may be headed towards a position where one country can decide what they do and without understanding what the consequences are for the rest of humanity. And the rest of humanity is saying, no, I really think you're not God. You shouldn't act as if you're God at all.
Your response, though, and I put this to either of you, I'm talking about September 11th, Pinochet, 1973, rising to power, thousands of Chileans killed. 1990, just after you were taken, Myrna Mack, the Guatemalan anthropologist, September 11th, 1990, was killed by Guatemalan forces. But your response to the administration and the Democrats who support the Republicans saying that we've got to take out Saddam Hussein precisely because he tortures people, because he is an international criminal, and so his country must be bombed.
Well, this is the case is, you know, I have dealt with Iraqi torture victims. I have spoken to them. I did not, and certainly Sister Tiana did not, nobody at this table provided gas to the Iraqi dictator for him to be able to gas his own people. This was done by the Americans. So I have been against Saddam Hussein for a long time, and we're against dictators in that sense. And we've been against them all the time, wherever they are, wherever they torture, whoever they torture. And I certainly would be the first one to be absolutely overjoyed if the Iraqi people were able to get rid of their dictator and put him on trial. They are the people who have suffered from him. They are the people who should put him on trial. Whether this is possible or not is something that we have to figure out. I think that if international pressure were brought to bear to do that, we would be able to do it in the sense of finding ways in which the people themselves will do this. But to suppose that we are going to get rid of the man who tortures, well, I would suggest there are some other people around, you know, who we could do. And to suppose that this suggests that we can go in, or the United States can go into any country and decide to take any torturer that they want, I mean, that they selectively decide, this is the torturer we're going to grab. I mean, they could start by grabbing Alejandro, right? The person who was there. They could start by grabbing Negroponte, who is himself the UN ambassador to the United States, who in fact is responsible in a great measure for all the horror that was visited upon Central America.
They could start by extraditing Toto Constant of Haiti, who's still here in the United States, and the Haitian government has been trying to get him back to stand trial for his torture in Haiti.
Well, this is a haven for torture. The United States is a haven for torturers. I mean, you know, and in fact, probably 10 years ago, if Saddam Hussein had been deposed, he would have ended up here, given safe haven here. So the fact is there are ways of dealing with torturers. And among other things, when Sister Diana organized this conference against torture, she invited people from the White House and people from the government to participate. They didn't even answer the call, as if they said, it's okay, you can just go ahead and torture. As long as you torture the people who we don't like, torture them. When you torture the people that we like, then, you know, we're going to go after you.
Sister Diana Ortiz, as we wrap up the program, what are you hoping to convey to the American people as you travel around the country now with your own testimony of what happened to you, you who survived and many who didn't, who you were with in Guatemala?
I'm one of the most important messages that I wish to convey is that today in our world there are more than 150 governments engaged in torture, and our government supports many of these governments. And I really call on the American people, please do whatever you can to prevent torture from destroying and shattering more lives. Our government talks about ending the war on terrorism. Torture is a form of terrorism. So that's my plea. Thank you.
I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Sister Diana Ortiz's book is published by a small independent press, Orbis. It's called The Blindfold's Eyes, My Journey from Torture to Truth, written with Patricia Davis. And Ariel Dorfman's book is Exorcising Terror, The Incredible Unending Trial of General Augusto Pinochet. That does it for the program. If you'd like to order a video cassette copy of today's program or an audio cassette, you can call 1-800-881-2359. 1-800-881-2359. Our website is www.democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Burke and Angie Karim, Anna Nogara, also Chris Abrams. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer and music maestro. Our email address, mail@democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! War and Peace Report.
For America, I went to Vietnam. Agent Orange has a whole...